Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's Casual Friday. That means Monday is Casual Monday, Tuesday, Casual Tuesday, Wednesday, Casual Hump Day, Thursday, Casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, May 25th, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Friday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Benjamin Dixon. He's the host of The Benjamin Dixon Show, political analyst and commentator. We're talking about the NFL's assault on free speech, the Democrats' failed response to this cultural event, the ongoing fallout of the cancellation of the summit with North Korea, and Trump saying, they're still talking. Plus, fear-mongering around MS-13 and getting real about U.S. policy in Central America. And then the great Ben Mankiewicz is here to talk movies, TV shows, and give us a recommendation. All that, plus the feds have lost about 1,475 migrant children. That's nice. And Ireland is voting right now on a referendum to repeal their Eighth Amendment and legalize abortion and generate reproductive justice for women in that country. We're monitoring that. If you're there, I think the polls are actually still open. Get out and vote on that vital issue. It's the dynamic duo today. The highest testosterone quota in the office. Matt Luck, Michael Brooks.
I think that's indisputable.
What's the Trump drop for that one?
Almost doesn't need to be said.
Oh, my God. We are off on Monday. I'm sure we have, I don't know what it is, but some good pre-record, I think. Or are we taking a show off?
We have a show on Monday. It's about corporations and how they came to claim more and more rights. I can't remember who the interviewee is, though.
It's communist. When you object to corporate rights, you're angry at God. And when you're angry at God, then the woman take control. Just read a terrifying new Jordan Peterson. Most Jordan Peterson write-ups make me laugh. This one that I read this morning from his former colleague in the psychology department at, University of Toronto, was actually a bit legitimately disturbing.
Harrowing, would you say?
Who's going to be the next global fascist leader? This crying hysteric.
I got the inside track.
Who's leading a revival of far-right fantasy crying politics? This guy. You know, like when I was having this image of like those terrifying, like those Maoist struggle sessions, and like the terror, like when Mao would visit a village, that if you didn't sort of whip yourself into an emotional frenzy, you could actually get imprisoned or tortured. I mean, just the sort of terror of that environment and the personality mimicking. And I was having this image of like the Peter, like all of us in Peterson world, like we all have to wear like sort of out of date suits. We need to figure, Matt, this would be dangerous for us. You and I are not big criers.
Or suit wearers in my case.
Yeah. I'm slightly improving, but the stuff that I'm wearing is still a little bit too up to date. And then you just be like forced, like locked into a room for like encounter therapy sessions where you're just like, ooh, the individual. All right. Well, that's speculative fascism. Let's deal with the actually occurring fascism of the regime we're living under today. There is a report, and this was talked about a couple weeks ago. There's a new policy initiative. Jeff Sessions said explicitly that if you are a migrant at the border, you will be separated from your children. in the latest act of terrorism against people who are either, let's say, undocumented or actually, in some cases, absolutely would fit a legal definition of refugee in terms of the situations they're facing and dealing with. And now it has been reported on the 22nd by E.J. Monatini, and I don't know what paper this is for.
Arizona Republic. Confirm.
Okay. That the Trump, and I'm quoting now, the Trump administration recently announced a Get Tough policy that will separate parents from their children if the family's caught crossing the border illegally. It was a big story, so big it overshadowed the fact that the federal government has lost 1,475 migrant children in its custody. Within 24 hours of being taken into custody, children are transferred to the Department of Health and Human Services, which finds them places to stay. They will be separated from their parents. So there are already, again, I'll just repeat that, 1,475 children, which the federal government has just lost track of after separating them from their parents. That, even before the formal announcing and move of this terrorist policy at the border, this is already happening. And now we shift over to a hearing that took place on Tuesday.
Same day as this article coming out,
with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Chief, ICE, Thomas Homan, attacking Democratic lawmaker Nanette Barragan of California for her questioning him on these moves and defending himself in a sanctimonious, self-righteous way and blaming Congress for his agency's conduct.
Great, thank you. I yield back.
Can I respond to the speech I was made?
Absolutely.
First of all, no one on this panel is anti-immigrant. We're law enforcement officers enforcing law that you all enacted. So to sit there and say that we're anti-immigrants is wrong. We are enforcing laws. If you think it's okay to enter this country illegally and they shouldn't be arrested, that's just wrong. The laws clearly state and you enter the country legally, it's a crime. And no one's up here saying all illegal aliens are criminals. A certain percentage of them are criminals. They commit yet another offense after they're here. I have said many times, I certainly understand the plight of these people, and I feel bad for some of these people. But I have a job to do. I have to enforce law and uphold the oath that I took to enact the laws enacted by you, Congress.
Yes, that's right. Going back to the 1990s, Bill Clinton, in fact, did sign laws where people who committed certain criminal activities could be deported back to their country of origin. And that has been effect. So, yes, Congress and the executive have passed and imposed some very, very xenophobic and broadly destructive policies, of which he is actively enforcing as head of an agency that needs to be abolished immediately. But we also see on a daily basis that agents under his authority are terrorizing people, selectively enforcing the laws, going up on two women in a parking lot because they're speaking Spanish, and all sorts of other things that Congress most certainly did not pass. So maybe instead of the sanctimonious whining, you could go find the over 1,000 children that you've already lost track of after you've separated them from your parents, which is what you're doing. It's disgusting.
Yeah. Does Congress need to pass a law explicitly stating don't lose 1,500 kids?
Yeah. Does Congress need to do that? Or is that just out of your control? And to some of the people that you feel bad for, or the plight of, do they include five-year-olds that you've ripped from their families and lost to in a massive bureaucracy where anything could happen to them in a context where they're potentially also fleeing a country filled with violence and dangerous situations that exceed Iraq, as an example? Is that part of the group that you feel bad for? ICE needs to be abolished immediately, and anybody that supported and aided any of these policies needs to be electorally punished and possibly legally investigated. It's disgusting. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Benjamin Dixon. This is the Majority Report.
Now in comes the musical team from the King's Offspring, Jesse Love.
Some people you're right, and them still choose to show you hate. Run them out of your yard,
From them a play bad kyo. I them a bad biters. Hypocritical to sideless. We call them modern day Judas. The spreaders of rumors. Oh, them a bad biters. Hypocritical to sideless. We call them modern day Judas. Spreaders of rumors. Hey, hey, so why should I be afraid of you? When you bleed just like I do, the more you try fight, judge your light keeps shining too. So I've got no time for you, cause in my view, you wanna step in on my shoe. You wish you never leave a loo and feel so damn confused. How every day you wake, you ache because you know you're fake. And every step you take, I bring you closer to your grave. But I am like a column when I easily shake. Me certain say I feel me none of who no can take. We guided by the monster, defender of the faith. Yes. Oh, them to be great. Oh, them a bad biters. Hypocritical to sideless. We call them modern day Judas. The spreaders of rumors. Oh, them a bad biters. Hypocritical to sideless. We call them modern day Judas. Spreaders of rumors. But your teeth and tongue gonna let you down. Reward for your words shall be profound. Oh, screw all you want, but go loo and drown. Me slew you like Goliath with a stone from a crown. Not even the dog that be set on the wall of Babylon shall escape in these times. So word to the wise, choose the right side. And down to be hindered by your foolish pride. I said no weapon formed against Zion and I shall prosper. Prosper. So tell me, support, strife, and more God of disrespect and face disaster.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Benjamin Dixon. He's the host of the Benjamin Dixon Show. Ben, thanks so much for being here.
Mr. Brooks, it's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure, man. Let's start briefly. Interesting Democratic primary result in your home state of Georgia. People
now
thought.
I guess it is my home state now, right? I live here now, but yeah.
That's my definition. I guess I'm kind of transient in that way. Where you live is where you are.
Well, that makes sense.
your current abode.
There we go.
How does that work?
That works better.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. People thought it'd be a lot closer than it was. There was a lot of dispute about, you know, who was the more progressive candidate. To be honest with you, I didn't follow the race particularly closely. I pretty much supported Stacey Abrams because people like Anola and you, who I trust, supported her. So that swayed me. But she had an interesting electoral argument and a base turnout argument, and it worked.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know why people thought it was going to be a close one. Mm-hmm. It was a blowout, and I didn't know it was going to be this much of a blowout, but I had every suspicion that she was going to do well. But she demolished Stacey Evans, and her strategy seems to be one that is working. Anoa Chonga wrote a piece for the Huffington Post outlining why that strategy is the strategy to move forward for the Democratic Party, turning out the base, speaking to the issues, all those critical things. She has been doing very consistently over the last year and a half, 2 years, year and a half that I've known of her campaign.
Do you think that the only other thing that's really interesting about this to me is that does this mean, especially, you know, with the changing nature of what any type of left coalition, particularly, I mean, nationally, but particularly in the South, it sort of seems to me that the Southern Democratic Party could morph from being, you know, obviously going from the, you know, pure Jim Crow apartheid Dixiecrats, but even through the kind of being, you know, the Bill Clinton third way kind of corporate Democrats, the future of the Southern Democratic Party could actually be the leading end of progressive Democratic politics.
No, it has to become that, right? Because particularly because of the influence of the black vote in the South and the revolutionary spirit of the black community. I don't think it, you know, the, people don't realize exactly how deep the revolution runs in the black community, black socialists, black socialists, democratic socialists of America who are winning these elections down here in the South. I think the path forward is to run as far as we possibly can away, not only from the third way economic policies of Bill Clinton, but also that that soft racism of the Clintons, that standing in front of Stone Mountain doing a speech in front of black prisoners version of the Democratic Party. That has to be put to bed permanently. And I think you have some voices, not only black voices, right? There are clearly other voices that are prominent in progressive circles here in the South. But I think it's an opportunity to do a hard pivot and to never look back to that third way Democrat strategy.
And then it's just a completely different historical moment. And then people will look to the South for forward momentum instead of trying to drag it from regress, which is fascinating.
I think that's actually great. I actually didn't think about that so much from that perspective. But to look to the South for leadership is definitely, I think, the path forward, because you're going to find those charismatic leaders, but well-qualified, and also those who are able to circumnavigate the problems of race in the South still. Like, you, if you grab a white person or a black person in the South, they understand the tensions and they understand how to navigate that through that to some success in the South. So I think there's some leadership that can come from the South for sure.
And this is all I just have to say, incredibly big of me to say, as a total northern chauvinist who still gets totally freaked out anytime I'm in the South.
You know, I've lived with both, so I understand why you would be. You know, it's not easy walking down the street. You just flew in from Brooklyn, and now you're in Georgia, and people are just saying hello out of the blue.
That's I was like, wait, I don't know you. I have to say, you know, the funniest thing, I flew in and you guys, we had a great time in Atlanta, and I actually really have fun every time I go out, particularly to Atlanta. But when I flew into Atlanta, and I wish I could remember this gentleman's name, I got out of the car and I was walking on this Georgia State University where I was giving a talk, and this real, you know, in my mind, kind of stereotypical southern looking gentleman kind of walked up to me, and I'm already, you know, I already had two or three like hellos of people I didn't know, so I was very skittish and kind of looking, casting a wary eye at all this politeness. And this guy walked up to me and got real close, and I was expecting him to like ask me for directions or something, or you know, whatever, or another you know, excessively friendly. And he's just like, "Hi, man, love the show, big fan." And I was like, wow. All right, Atlanta. Fair enough.
The accent's pretty good, too. That's a pretty good accent of the South, though.
Well, I'm up for spending more time. All right, so let's go. I do want to touch on the NFL. I talked about this yesterday. My frame for this, in some ways, that I think needs to really be injected into the conversation, is that if you want to worry about free speech, and I, in many ways, I'm a strong free speech advocate. Private enterprise is the biggest threat to free speech there is in the United States. And this is a prime example of that, along with the obvious Trump-fueled racial politics of that. I want you to give me a response, and then we're going to play a clip of Nancy Pelosi responding to this, which was just sad.
Yeah, I was watching that live. We are hiding behind, and when I say we, I don't mean us, I mean conservatives generally, but hide behind the ability of corporations to censor our speech. And it actually is far worse when you consider their ability to threaten your livelihood, yep. Right? And then you also consider the implications of how they can control you, your political activism, and anything that would challenge them and challenge their economic structure from which they benefit. I mean, we've just skimmed the surface of the ability of private corporations to be the far more nefarious and insidious version of Big Brother than the government could ever hope to be, because we've willingly turned over freedoms like never before to private industry. So just from that perspective alone, that's a terrifying notion. But then just the sheer hypocrisy of it, right? You know, there is, of course, the NFL is a private company. They have the right to do this. That's never the question. But I don't know if they see the inconsistency in their arguments when it's time to defend the speech of Nazis, and they don't really care that they're private corporations that are censoring the speech. They still lament over the loss of free speech. But now here in this case, oh, they're perfectly fine. Ben Shapiro's perfectly fine with it. It's okay. Tommy, whatever her name is, is okay with it. Conservatives in general, they're okay with it. So it's just fascinating to see how brazenly they, you know, the hypocrisy is never surprising, but it always is something to behold how they absolutely have no concern about standing on the side with Nazis and then opposing black athletes, particularly in this case.
Well, we played a clip yesterday that we found of Richard Spencer actually saying explicitly, I don't remember how long ago it was now, but sometimes relatively recently, explicitly saying that, of course, we, and this is, these are, you know, his words now, not mine, that yes, we oppose free speech, but we're going to use it as a tool for our politics. And it should just be axiomatic. You know, the burden on us as democratic socialists or actual liberals in the proper usage of that word, by which I mean essentially in this context, people who actually do support and defend free speech, the burden is always going to be that fascists have always used free speech as a tool to destroy free societies. And this is the classic. It's so I think it's hypocrisy, but it's also a very intentional strategy that you see writ large. And that's also why you only see, you know, there's very few people that are going to come out that are in that sort of lane and say, well, this is, you know, totally wrong. And this is the same thing we've been complaining about, because they're using this language as a political tool, a line of attack for a certain kind of politics, not because they're actually concerned about the value of open society.
You're plagiarizing my podcast from today that I just published. So you haven't even heard. That's literally what I was saying in today's episode. Like, this is strategic. This is very intentional. They will use free speech to their benefit and then withhold it from us. But most of all, though, if you're in terms of hypocrisy, you can count on conservatives being consistent for one thing and one thing only, to protect this power structure from ever being challenged, from ever being changed, from ever benefiting marginalized people. Whatever side of any argument they have to be on, no matter how hypocritical it makes them seem, you can consistently count on conservatives being on the side of defending power. And this is what this is about in the NFL. It's about NFL owners trying to show that they literally own these people, and they can tell them to jump and they better ask how high. And then on the flip side, it's about Donald Trump and the conservatives trying to protect power. This is not about disrespecting the flag, disrespecting the nation. That's language that they use to maintain power.
That's exactly it. And that's a sort of intellectual rigor and moral clarity that obviously was mirrored and echoed by House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi. Or was it? Let's play this clip and see how she responded to this NFL attack on free speech.
We just had a rule change by the NFL today. Okay? When the anthem comes on, you stand. If you do not want to stand, stay in the locker room. If you come out onto the field and you kneel or you in other ways protest, you will be fined. Are you okay with this rule change by the NFL?
I would be more okay with it if they had consulted with the players. I don't think the players agreed to this. This was the owners. And by the way, it's the owners who would be fined. I love the national anthem. I mentioned earlier to Jesus that I'm from Baltimore. That's where it was written during the War of 1812. So I'm very possessive of it. Sometimes people say, maybe we should change the national anthem. No, I'm from Baltimore. I love the national anthem, and I love the flag. Our homes are all decorated with flags. It's such a beautiful thing. And I love the First Amendment, and I'll just leave it at that. I love the First Amendment.
It really makes you think.
Deepen. So anyway, let me tell you, man, I used to work for this company that did liberal progressive kind of videos. That company has since gone out of business. But one of the main problems we had there was that we covered the NFL story too much for them. You know, liberals, they love the NFL. Some, you know, they love the flag, just like what's her name just said. And so part of the problem in this fight isn't just conservatives being inconsistent and conservatives using this as a strategy to attack us. It's also fighting against liberals who are tired of having to talk about this and tired of you interfering with their football game. You know, oh, you want us to protest? Nah, man, I love the Dallas Cowboys too much. This kind of thing, something that I face regularly, not from conservatives, but from liberals who probably will star in the next episode of Get Out.
That was in the chamber, but it worked. I like it. Yeah, though, I mean, Nancy Pelosi, there's a lot of Get Out scenarios there. Let's pivot to North Korea, because as we said, we have Benjamin Dix. Every time Ben and I do something, we had to run deep and play on all surfaces. So let's move to the global. Let's move to the Asian, to the Korean Peninsula. The summit was canceled, obviously, which is kind of the top line. Today, though, Trump is actually back to a sort of somewhat conciliatory, you know, they're still doing this dance. He said, look, we're still talking with them. It still would be great to meet. The North Koreans released similarly sort of, I mean, one statement they released, which I covered yesterday, which was justifiable, frankly, was that Mike Pence's Fox News interview was incredibly stupid. Which it was, stupid, belligerent, and dangerous. And then they said, you know, we can meet in negotiations or in a nuclear showdown, which the top line obviously is disturbing. But again, they're still sending those dual signals of we really do want to have these meetings. And Trump is doing the same thing. It seems clear to me that, you know, Trump finally realized that he was basically just getting rolled in the whole process. But, you know, the reality is that there isn't going to be a solution to this. I mean, the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, said last year, he said, we created a deal that nobody likes, which is why it's a good deal and it works, because that's what deals are. And, you know, obviously they've taken a sledgehammer to that and made the world a much worse place with regards to Iran. It's going to be the same thing with North Korea. So it's like, what's this dance here? And is it just, you know, this guy's weird personality, I'm talking about Trump, that is going to, you know, determine what happens?
Ironically, you'd be talking about, you know, people would suspect that you were talking about either, but no, specifically Trump in this case. Yes. I like the angle you put on that, right? This is Trump at the last second realizing that North Korea was, particularly Kim Jong-un, he was steamrolling. He was gaslighting the president a little bit with hopes of possibly something good coming out of it. But I think that they backpedaled extremely too hard. The interview with Mike Pence was extremely disturbing and unnecessary, right? It was not the letter from Donald Trump that apparently he dictated himself, which is apparent in the language, was enough where North Korea was like, hey, we still want to meet with you.
Right.
And to me, that was a surprising position to come from a regime that has cast in the international community as a rogue regime. No, they seem, with their initial response, to be willing to deal with even Donald Trump's backpedaling. So the entire Fox News interview to me was like particularly overkill, because it wasn't necessary to change the power dynamics in favor of the United States. Donald Trump, he did that with his incoherent letter, because North Korea still wants to get assimilated into the international community. They still want the assurances for the Kim regime. They still want all of the things that they began building their nuclear arsenal for in the first place. And so what is the dance for? I think it's a recalibration. Donald Trump is trying to not going. He's trying to not come out of this looking like a fool, because ultimately it's not going to be a deal. And the context that you gave is perfect. It's not going to be a deal that he can brag about and say that it's a perfect deal. No, it's going to be a deal along the lines of the Iranian nuclear deal, which he, you know, single-handedly is starting to destroy.
Well, and except, you know, it will be from a U.S. perspective worse, because, you know, the Iranians actually didn't have a weapon and were nowhere near as advanced as the Koreans, right? So the lesson, again, for any government facing, or any regime, whatever word we're going to use, facing this kind of situation, the lesson from Iraq, Libya, and now Iran is you better weaponize as quickly as possible if you want to avert either, you know, an invasion or an exceeded UN mandate, or just frankly, you know, I mean, God knows what they're planning with Iran. That's incredibly dangerous and disturbing. But I think that what's funny, and this is where you know, Trump, it's unusual the degree to which this guy's eccentricities and weirdness do matter in policy, which isn't, you know, a lot of times we're kind of, I think, trying to say like, hey, even when you're talking about a place like North Korea, it's not just a question of, you know, this crazy kid running the country. There's even there's a bureaucracy, there's internal power dynamics. He's, you know, fending off generals that might want to move against him, right? Like everything has its power dynamics. But with Trump, it does seem like, and it kind of reminds me of some stuff I read about with Ronald Reagan, where, you know, he had sort of, you know, he liked the war movies and that, you know, made him very hawkish and militaristic in his language. But he also loved like 1950s movies about like space aliens coming down and making humanity all work together. And that was what made him actually at times like strikingly progressive on disarmament proposals with Mikhail Gorbachev. And for some reason with Trump, and even you're right, in that letter, I think he did dictate it because it's very Trump. Like, it could be beautiful, it could be great. He has in his mind, for some reason, the notion that, and honestly, maybe there is an element of just like personal admiration for this kid, for Kim Jong-un. Like, I could see a continuum there of admiration from Trump for that authoritarian leadership. He does seem to have it stuck in his mind that there can be something positive and peace-like here. And obviously, given the alternatives and given the dangerous people that are around him, like Pence and Bolton, I mean, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, listen, like I said, if Donald Trump gets any recognition in this process, it is the extent to which he does not destroy the potential for peace.
Right.
And if we calculate into that some whatever his motivations will be, maybe he saw the day the earth stood still. Right? maybe that's in his calculus and in the back of his heart, you know, he wants a modicum of peace on the international stage. Then by all means, you know, I hope he plays up to that, because I mean, considering here's the other thing, you know, you mentioned John Bolton. We knew that there was going to be a recalibration once he got into office.
Right.
I'm not sure to what extent this move by Trump was headed up or initiated by Bolton. But so far, it seems as though we haven't gone to the logical extreme of what he can do. And so if this is the extent of the recalibration with John Bolton being in office, I knock on wood, so far so good. I'm afraid to actually say that. Right. It could be a lot worse. So you know, I'm not really sure exactly what the cause or the impetus of this move by Trump. But you know, let's see if they, because I'm actually pulling for it, right?
Yeah.
I don't want him to get the Nobel Peace Prize because I don't think he deserves it, but that's neither here nor there. If we can pull this off, then by all means, I want the president to be successful in this regard.
Of course.
If in no other way, but not being the destructive force that he can be. So however we can get it done, let's get it done.
How much empathy or concern do you feel for Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, who's actually been very adroit and effective in this process? He's managing two lunatics with shifting internal dynamics while his country would be actually, you know, people get into these abstractions about what a ballistic missile from North Korea, like where it could reach the United States and all this stuff. South Korea could be destroyed by conventional weapons immediately if this stuff actually blew up. And South Korea is obviously a very advanced country. And he's also coming in on the momentum of an anti-corruption and peace and anti-militarism movement in South Korea, which has a lot of complaints about U.S. militarism on the peninsula and wants things to cool down. And he's trying to manage all these variables.
Right. I think what he's done has been nothing short of brilliant, right, and commendable. And, you know, I hate to keep referencing the Nobel Peace Prize because I don't think that should be the bar, right?
But Henry Kissinger won a Nobel Peace Prize, so yeah.
Exactly. Right. That's not the bar that we should measure with, but apparently that's the one in our currently being brought out of the lexicon. But, you know, if anybody is noteworthy in this process, it has been President Moon. It has been his ability to circumnavigate these two maniacs, right, and to play You know, to whatever degree he has to coddle Donald Trump, he's been willing to do that. To whatever degree he's had to coddle Kim Jong-un, he's been willing to do that. He's been able to manage the internal dynamics. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on him from the revolution that carried him into office.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And so he's got to raise to the bar, raise to the standard that they expect of him. And this is a major or potentially a major setback for him. So I'm curious to see what his next move would be, because I think his previous moves have been so critical to getting us to this point. So we should. Yeah, you're right. I think we should look to him to see how he's going to circumnavigate this latest hiccup.
And China as well, because China, obviously, yeah, they are the sort of primary factor in terms of an ability to exert influence on North Korea.
Yeah.
And so maybe it is just as simple as China getting on the phone and, you know, asking if Trump wants some more like discount sweatshops or Ivanka to manufacture underwear or something, and the summit will be back on.
Hey man, hey, every deal has its dirt. So
right. Every deal has its dirt. It's just like what the black guy said. Exactly. It's a great point. He got it. Jesus Christ! All of our brains are melting. I want to talk a little bit about MS-13, just in the context of, you know, I think it's important for us to follow this. It can kind of get lost in the noise. It's on my mind because I was on, you know, one of those global networks a couple days ago, and I was pitted against, you know, some just ultra maniac who was talking about, you know, military deployments to round up immigrants and all of this, you know, absolutely fascist stuff. And, you know, Trump was in Long Island, where there is actually MS-13 activity, right? And there, and this is no doubt, it's a brutal gang. It's involved in some very serious criminal activity. But there's sort of two things about it that strike me. One is that MS-13, from its connections with certain Mexican cartels to the fact that it arose out of environments in Central America that have been defined by U.S. policy, from coups to weapons shipments to training death squads to, you know, a drug war where we have backed, you know, right-wing forces and juntas and harmed farmers and indigenous communities across Latin America. This is the context where this group came out of. And also, this is a time where, in some cases, some of the, you know, people at the border that we're torturing literally are refugees that are fleeing MS-13 in El Salvador, where it might actually be a national security threat in that country versus a, you know, a gang that does horrible things in localities in the United States, but is nothing remotely in approaching anything that we need to talk about nationally. So there's a way in which we need to track it as the sort of main Trump propaganda project for demonizing and racializing all immigrants. And that's their buzzword. But also we could use it as a door to get serious about a whole other variety of pernicious U.S. policies in the region that generate the environment for a group like MS-13.
Would have to ask, like, who else would get serious about American involvement in the creation and the fostering of a group like MS-13? Like, you know, that type of imperialist activity is something that's heavy on our radar already.
Yep.
But I mean, I don't know anyone else. I don't even think you're going to get Democrats who are going to be motivated to look at this as an issue of American activities in the region. You most certainly are going to get Republicans to do that. So I mean, I don't want to be Debbie Downer here, but to me, it's like that's almost like hopeful, a little too hopeful for this current environment. I mean, I'm not sure that America is ready to be any more introspective than it has ever been in the past.
Well, I think that's true, but that, I mean, I guess it's like, one, it's, you know, so this is what I did in my segment. I was like, okay, you want to talk about these, you know, the context in Central America? Sure. There's plenty of policies that we could pivot that would undermine the context for these groups. And it actually leads me to a second question I have for you. We've been talking a lot about, you know, litmus tests for Democratic candidates. I agree, you know, the really easy and basic ones are, you know, you want to run for president in 2020. I mean, the obvious stuff, you know, Medicare for all, postal banking, I would add breaking up the banks, financial reform, and serious policies on immigration rights and criminal justice and policing, no doubt. I do think we need to start injecting some litmus tests on some foreign policy issues. I think it's not good enough. I think, like, you want to come out and talk about how left you and how you're part of this new movement of humanitarian politics and you're going to defend what Israel does in Gaza? No. What is your plan to restore, the Obama administration's one of their most important achievements and legacy, what happened in Iran? And I actually think, even though it's, you know, less on the radar, but if you want to talk about immigration and explain that you're going to really diverge and move away from the, you know, obscenity of the Trump years, but also, let's be blunt, a lot of the mistakes and wrongs of the Obama era as well with regard to immigration, not to mention the Clinton administration, which actually signed some very repressive immigration legislation. I mean, you're going to have to, on some level, I think, talk about foreign policy. And I agree with you, it's never going to be at the forefront in the same way for the American public, but I do wonder if on the left we need to start injecting some of these foreign policy conversations as a sort of demand set on foreign policy as well. I mean, it's kind of worked with Bernie. He doesn't talk. I mean, the stuff he had to say about the Gulf monarchies was ridiculous in 2016, and he's pivoted.
So actually, you've made your case, and I'm actually going to change my mind here live on air. From that perspective, using it as a litmus test to push and push and push and push. We've been successful with that. I mean, we've so far, like since 2016, we've pushed quite a few candidates to the left on some key issues. So I'm going to change my mind live on air. Yeah, do it. I think that's critical. And that's the only opportunity that we're going to have to actually make them care. So from that perspective, if we can force the Democratic Party to care about it, then by all means, I'd say go for it.
I love it. I was able to persuade Benjamin Dixon on air. That is no mean feat. Although actually we have,
and I'm not easily persuaded.
No, you're not
persuaded.
Not at all. Although at times you and I have a mutual persuasion society, I would say. Final question. How are you? Just give you a super generic cable news style question because I am curious your thoughts. How are you feeling about, you know, now I think we can start doing a little bit more midterm speculation. It's getting a little bit more real now. How are you feeling about it?
The horse race.
Yeah.
I think it looks good. Look at Georgia, right? What happened with Stacey Abrams in 2014, Republicans had 240,000 more Republicans turn out to vote in the midterms. In the primaries. And this year it was only 50,000 more in a red, deep state. Mm. There's indicators like that all across the country that they're, for lack of a better phrase, a blue wave. I'm hoping that blue wave is a progressive wave. But, you know, if we're just going to look at the horse race, I think it's going to go like you would see in any midterm election. You're going to see a swing. And before, I think in 2016, most people thought that there was no way that there was going to be enough swing, enough of a wave for the Democrats to take back one of the houses. And I think that conventional wisdom has gone out with the wind because of the nature of Donald Trump, for one. They're going to take a house. I'm not sure which one, I'm not ready to make those kind of predictions.
Yeah.
But the wave is genuine. And whether or not the Democrats have the ability to mess that up, I mean, that's the wild card here.
If anybody could snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, it's the Democratic Party.
Democratic Party.
Benjamin Dixon, I appreciate your time as always. Everybody, of course, if you haven't yet, check out the Benjamin Dixon Show. You can find all of the links on the Majority Report homepage. He's a regular on this show and, of course, my show, TMBS, Michael Brooks Show, and you can find me over on his show as well. Benjamin, as always, really appreciate your time.
So thanks for having me.
Thank you, man. All right, everybody. We are going to take we're going to take a brief break, and we will be right back. We'll keep it moving with Ben Mankiewicz of Turner Classic Movies and the Young Turks. Welcome back. Michael Brooks on the Majority Report. Joining us now from Turner Classic Movies and the Young Turks is Ben Mankiewicz. Ben, how you doing?
Michael, I'm well. It's nice to talk to you.
It's always a pleasure. How is it out there today?
It's lovely. I love it out here. I'm a fierce defender of Los Angeles.
You are a fierce defender.
You're always running into smart, clever, funny people, you know. I don't find this city even any particularly phonier than any other city.
Well, I buy that. Country. Yeah, this is a phony. Right, I buy that. I want to pull out from personal experience how much of an L.A. defender you are. I think the last time I was out in L.A., yeah, it was last time, you and I were, I went and did the Young Turks, and then you and I went to go grab some food. And so we were driving, and we caught a little bit of, like, the one stereotype I will say about L.A. that's absolutely true is that the traffic is unbelievable. And we were, like, catching a little bit of that L.A. traffic. And you still were in the middle of a monologue about how great the city was. And I was like, wow, this guy is really committed.
But here's the thing. The traffic is unbelievable. It's not always terrible. It's just unbelievable because you can't figure it out. Like, I mean, you know, I go to Atlanta for Turner Classic Movies. Obviously, I'm in New York a bunch, and I lived in Miami. D.C. has horrible traffic where I grew up. Like, I don't know that it's worse than any of those places, but sometimes it is so puzzling. Like, we were trying to go, like, 800 yards, and it took 29 minutes. So, like, we couldn't figure it out. You can't park. You can't move. So that was, some days you're like, what is happening? Why is it like this? But one of the things about L.A., and I love talking about how to get from point A to point B anywhere in the country. I realize I'm fairly alone in that. But is that you have options. Like, there are always choices in L.A. about how to get places. And I had a good friend growing up, a guy named Mike Roseman, still a good friend of mine, and his dad is gone now, but his name was Lou Roseman. And Lou, from the age of 11, like, we'd come over to Mike's house, and he'd be like, how'd you get here? I'm like, I don't know, man. I sat in the car while my dad drove. He goes, yeah, but did he take Fessenden or did he cut through on Harrison? I'm like, man, Lou, I don't know. And now all I want to do is talk to Lou.
That was what you were doing. That's true. And it's also great because in L.A., like, of course, like, I have no idea. I don't live there. I don't know the city at all. You're just like, oh, what we're going to do? We're going to trick. I don't know. I'll make up names. We're like, oh, yeah, we're going to go. We're going to do a U-turn on La Cita, and then we'll get on the. And I'm like, all right, dude. Sounds good. I don't know.
It's always I literally can talk about that forever. It never bores me.
It's like it's very like baseball stats of you. I feel like that's the closest mode.
There's no deep dive into baseball that I'm not into, and there is no how do you get to the valley at 3:45 on a Thursday that I'm also not into.
Can I ask you a question? This is kind of the movie sort of TV segment. Obviously, you're the perfect man to do that with. And I am curious. I just started watching Billions. Do you watch that show?
Yeah.
Is that a show?
I watch it. One of my best friends is on it.
So that was a question I was going to ask you. I'm sorry for people who don't watch this. I won't take up too much time with this, but I really like the show. Is Dollar Bill your buddy?
Yeah, Dollar Bill is my friend, Kelly. And he's also plays Pastor Tim on The Americans, which is one of the five best shows in the history of television, wraps up next Wednesday night. Anybody should binge that, catch up on it. It's just great, great geopolitical stuff and great personal drama. And Spycraft, which I also love. So baseball stats, how to get from point A to point B, and the craft of spying.
Which is sort of like a fusion.
The lingo.
That's sort of like a fusion, I would say. Like, Spycraft is a mashup of how to get to point A, point B, and baseball statistics.
That's right. That's exactly what it is. I think your audience would dig Billions because it's both, it examines both the sort of warped morality of Wall Street and the equally warped morality of the people who are supposed to watch over Wall Street. And their motivations are only about doing justice for the greater good when it suits them. Mostly it's about personal gain. So, but it's a fun show, man. It's not a heavy show. It is fun.
It's super fun. But I do actually have a question about that because that show, like, obviously I'm not under any, like, in fact, I find even, like, the kind of Preet Bharara sort of hero worship kind of embarrassing, to be honest. But what's funny about that show is that, yes, it examines the warped morality of Wall Street, and it also shows you that, you know, the people in the DA's office are certainly, well, one of them, I would argue, Paul Giamatti's sort of his main kind of his right hand actually is pretty ethically upright, which is why he's getting pretty steadily screwed during every arc of the show. But what's kind of funny about it is that Axe, you know, the Wall Street guy, yeah, he's a scumbag, but he's the fun one and he's the cool one and he's the likable one. So it does kind of play that, you know, there is that sort of capitalist American apology in it, because it's like, yeah, this guy's a scumbag, but at least he's not like an uptight hypocritical square. And who would you prefer to party with, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, that's a reality. So
right.
I'm not, yeah, I mean,
right.
They may reinforce that, but I'm not, yeah, I mean, I don't want to hang out with an uptight hypocritical square.
Oh, hell no.
I mean, you know, it goes back to the question back in November where we had to decide, you know, who'd you rather hang out with, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton? And it was fun to answer, oh, I mean, obviously you'd rather spend the day with Donald Trump. We're a year and a half in, and now, no. So that answer was wrong, too.
Yeah, it's but, pretty exhausting.
Yeah.
Just like, I think you'd like to spend like 40 minutes with Donald Trump and then write about like the kind of like the 10th time that he told you about like an apprentice ratings arc. You'd be like, all right, I need to get out of here.
No, I think it's like, sure, Joseph Goebbels was, he was probably fun in the room for a while. And then at some point, he's going to talk about how the Jews are taking over the media. And you're going to be like, oh, Jesus, I can't hang out with this guy. I now don't think you could even spend 40 minutes with Donald Trump. That was one of the many, many, many things in the last two or three years that I've been 100% wrong about.
I have a question about the Americans too, actually, because I do also I lost track of it. I got to catch up with it.
But one this final season of the Americans is one of the great seasons in television history.
It's such a good show, and I don't, you know, you. I'm going to just ask you. I'll just put it on the table. You would know better than me. So I was born in the 80s, obviously. So I didn't, you know, I don't know this stuff in the same way. But I was born in the early 80s outside of DC. And one of the things that I like about the show is it's like it feels to me, and I wouldn't know this, but it feels to me like, oh, I'm kind of getting like what the 80s were like, not just in terms of like how people dressed and like, you know, how bad the outfits were and stuff, but even like when they go to like the EST seminars or like the music they're listening to, like I feel like I'm getting a flavor of like what that culture was like. Is that
true?
They do
as good a job as any show has done of capturing a time and place. It's like the 1980s equivalent of Deadwood, which was to me still the best show that's ever aired on television for capturing time and place. Like you watch Deadwood and you're like, okay, this is what the West was like.
Wow.
It was muddy, it was dirty, it was awful, it was lawless. And I can't wait till the next episode, right? The Americans really does a great job on capturing the 80s, and specifically D.C. in the 80s, even though they shoot it almost entirely in Brooklyn.
Really? They shoot in Brooklyn?
Everything's in Brooklyn. And sometimes now, as you're watching this last season, you're like, oh, they're in a D.C. park. That's not a D.C. park. That's obviously New York. But it doesn't matter.
That's funny.
They do a great job of getting around that. Yeah, they shoot the show in Brooklyn. They do a great job. You know, as somebody who spends his life sort of paying attention to movies and television to some extent also, music does not have a profound effect on me in shows. But the review show that I do on The Americans that I've done for years with Alonzo Duralde at What the Flick, you know, and everybody else who comes in and talks about The Americans, all they talk about is the music. I literally missed, like, every music cue that every show has ever had. But they clearly have got it. They have wonderful little 80s references. They get the right handheld video games that kids were playing, you know, because those kids are sort of other, you know, 13, 14 years old. And the show is exactly the age that I was. Like, it starts in 1981, and their kids are basically 14. That is a time that I remember very well, and they capture it. They capture it really perfectly.
So what is this music thing? Are you generally an anti-music guy?
No, I love music. I just don't. It does not. No, it doesn't. The way like my wife could buy a couple of Matisse's and a Monet and put them up in our house, And 9 months later, I would say, "Is that what did, I, did you just put that in?" And she'd go, "No." And I go, "Oh, who, what is that?" She would go, "That's a Matisse." And I go, "He's an artist, right?"
You go, "Hey, that's is good. That is? Nice. Hey, honey, what's that? What's that new piece of fruit that's up in the living room? I like that."
Yeah, I don't like it. Just doesn't my brain will remember lines of dialogue. And it'll remember looks, and I love the way actors talk to each other, and I love to, I listen, I go back over again and again, somebody will say something clever, and I'll be like, "Look at that line, look at how he delivered that line." And the music will come, and I'm like, "Oh, that's nice," but I instantly forget it. It just doesn't resonate in my brain. I listen to music all the time, but it doesn't, you know, we review movies, and they'll talk the music afterwards, and I'm always like, I've just, for a long time, I'd fake my way through. I'd be like, "Oh, yeah, it was really, oh, perfect." now I just shut up. But now I just think, I'll notice it when it's too much. Like, you know, when they're, I'm like, "I got it. I'm supposed to be sad. Thank you for telling me that I'm supposed to be sad."
But yeah, some shows are real ham-handed with that, where it's like, "Okay, man, I understand."
And yeah,
like you're cueing me a little too much here.
The Americans are good at it. They figured it out.
Well, I remember, and it's funny because it's not really, I mean, I think, you know, sometimes music will pop up that just is still like played or you heard your parents play it or whatever. And I remember the season that, and I'm not doing a spoiler, I mean, I guess a general spoiler, but whatever. I don't really believe in spoilers, but I want to get your opinion on that too. But the season with the ANC arc, which obviously I really liked because of my, you know, South Africa focus, there was a scene, and I won't spoil the scene, but they put this like Fleetwood Mac song under it. And I just remember being like I'm not a big, you know, I don't hate Fleetwood Mac. Like, they're cool, I guess. But this is just a group that would never occur to me one way or another. And they bedded this scene with it. And I was like, "Jesus, that is a cool song." Like, I had no idea how good that song was until they set it for that scene.
Let me tell you a couple things that you're wrong about. I have a long list. But I'll just,
okay, please, go ahead.
First of all, I would argue that Fleetwood Mac is the third greatest band of all time.
Wow. Hold on one second. Hold on. We've got a... Is my board up? You just got yourself a Law and Order hammer for that one, dude.
Yeah, they are... and I've always liked Fleetwood Mac, but I must say in the last 6 to 9 months, there has been an enormous Fleetwood Mac. I mean, my daughter, she's 5 years old, and every Monday morning, she's singing Monday Morning.
That's cute, because
I've never seen them in concert, but they're going to tour again this year. Essentially, you know, without Lindsey Buckingham, which is like, "Ladies and gentlemen, here's the E Street Band. Bruce Springsteen could not make tonight's performance."
Well, like the Wailers still tour without Bob Marley. I mean, and let's go see the Wailers at some like bar in Hoboken. Okay.
Yeah, it's not quite the same thing, but nonetheless, I am I'm eager to see Fleetwood Mac, and I listen to them more than Springsteen now, which is strange for me. But
let's go see them together, man.
I've fallen in love with Fleetwood Mac, and it was partly because people I like were telling me how, you know, I'm like, no, Fleetwood Mac is an unbelievable band. And also their story is this greatest drama. They basically all slept with each other and lived in the same house, and then wrote about the pain and difficulty of that. So it's an amusing story to all of them.
That sounds super intense. Let's go see Fleetwood Mac together, man.
I would love that.
I have to ask you if they're, well, actually, I'm going to tell you a music story in a second, but if not Fleetwood Mac, if they're three, who are one and two, and if elaborate on your wrongness with these picks.
Well, first of all, I'm not wrong, but the great thing about saying something like third, like I my dad's birthday was a week ago, 8 days ago, on May 16th, I posted a great photo of him that was, I guess, the Washington Post, and he looks sort of crazy in these photos, and I was like, you know, "Happy birthday to the 13th smartest guy in American history." And people are instantly like, "Who are the first 12? And I'm like, "Hey, man, you're missing the point. I don't know. I didn't make a list and he came in 13th. Like, you're missing the point. I don't know one and two. I'm just saying.
Dude, you're the baseball stats direction guy, if anybody would.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, look, if it had been funnier to say fifth, I'd have said fifth, but I thought third worked.
Third does work. Third is a very, it's like both very laudatory and very diplomatic pick.
You know, when I went to journalism school, they were big on, you know, if you found out that 1,517 kids under 13 in New York City.
Ben. Oh, no. I think we lost him. Ben. Yeah, I'm going to call him right back. All right, Benjamin Mankiewicz, children under 13, New York City Journalism School. Go ahead.
Yeah, so like in journalism school, if you'd found out that these that 1,538 kids had been deprived of food stamp services because of some cut to the program, and you were covering it in a story in journalism school at Columbia, they would tell me to say 1,500. Right? Roughly 1,500 kids.
Right.
And I argued then and argue now that the specificity is critical.
Right. 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 Right.
I was doing I'm doing some work for the wonderful organization Stand Up to Cancer, and I learned this week that basically 4,754 people are diagnosed with cancer in America every day.
Jesus.
Right?
Yeah.
And so saying nearly 5,000 people are diagnosed with cancer every day, that's how that would be written most of the time. And I would insist that you write 4,754, that specificity and numbers make them stand out and make them mean something to people.
Yeah.
And that's why third and not fifth for Fleetwood Mac.
A couple years ago, I got given, I might have told you this story, but I'll tell it to everybody. I'm not sure whether I told you this story, but I basically got a couple of tickets, and I took a girl I was seeing at the time to go see U2 at Madison Square Garden. And first we went, and it was like they were really nice tickets. Like they were like floor level, and you know, it was just kind of like, all right, obviously I'm not going to turn those down. And I don't dislike U2, but they don't really mean anything. Again, they don't mean anything. They definitely don't mean anything to me one way or another.
I'm with you. That's how I feel. Yeah. They're obviously good. You would go see them if you got offered free tickets, but they don't. They're not part of what moves me.
Exactly. Same sentiment. And then it was funny because first we went there, and we were just like, you know, girl I was with was black, and we were doing like a joke of like how many people in the stands aren't white that aren't like members of like security, and that was funny. Like the point was just like sort of like it was nice, but we were not like that engaged, you know, kind of, you know,
right,
going off to get drinks, whatever. But again, I'm not trying to throw shade on them. They still clearly were great, and there's a charisma, and it was great, but whatever. It just isn't, you know, there's things I love that aren't other people's thing, right? And
yeah,
and so then I've liked him probably more than Fleetwood Mac, but I think I've always had somewhat, or excuse me, liked him more than U2. But I, you know, Bruce Springsteen is a guy that like I get that he's very cool and important, but it's not something I'm going to listen to on the subway or, you know, put on a party or whatever. They said, you know, we have a surprise person, whatever, and they brought Bruce Springsteen down on the stage, and dude, all of a sudden, me and her, we just locked in. And I was like, and my mother, you know, she's from Long Island. She's a huge Bruce Springsteen fan. And I texted her some video of him singing. And I was like, you know what? I get it. This guy is a fucking rock star.
I
it was a completely different experience. It was crazy.
I've seen him, you know, 40 times and would see him really as many times as I'm capable of. And each time is different. It's again, I sort of decided, it's like going to your favorite restaurant. Nobody says, I can't believe you went to that restaurant again. You're like, hey, people, you know, it's cool when you have a restaurant you like and you go a lot. There's nothing wrong with that, right? So
right,
each experience is a little different,
yeah,
satisfying. So I've taken a couple people who aren't big Bruce fans, and I haven't converted all of them, but most have that reaction. I mean, maybe that's not like they go out and buy all the albums, but they certainly come away thinking, okay, I this is different. Like that, we took a couple of British women, my wife and I, friends of hers, and we had great seats where I try to get on the floor and stand.
Yep.
And they were literally, these women in their 40s were like, oh my God, like,
yeah,
I can't. So that was the sexiest person I have ever been near.
Like that just he exude and they weren't huge fans. Talented. They just exuded something
pure. Well, and it was crazy because it was so much charisma, but he was also so like generous with them hosting him. I don't know. I just know. And then we got in the car, and I was like, and just like basically that was the big take. It was like, well, I guess we love Bruce now. I had no idea. It was unbelievable.
And then you throw in the, you know, the sort of committed progressive politics and the reading. You know,
right.
The guy just reads. And then that he wrote this book and he didn't, you know, this is like, there's nobody of his level who, to me, and that I know of, and I'm sure there are, somebody will say it, but nobody in the entertainment industry who has written their own autobiography without any help.
Right.
Right. I mean, that is his voice. And he was like, oh, I'll write this. And because he's turned into a, and his show, if you have a chance to go see him, you know, the ticket prices I'm given to understand are coming down. But if you can, nobody should pay $1,000 to go see any show.
Right.
But if you can get in to see Springsteen on Broadway, you don't have to know his songs. You don't have to love him. But if you, that's what I tell people now, if you, and I'd rather see the, I'd rather see him in concert. I'd rather see the E Street Band than that Broadway show. But that Broadway show still is, if you have a good relationship with your parents or a terrible relationship with your parents or something in between, then that show will speak to you.
That's awesome. I want to do actually, Matt, do we have the Steve Kerr sound ready? I want to play you the, I'll get your movie recommendation in a couple minutes, but I wanted to touch briefly on this NFL thing because it's, you know, terrible and I wanted to get your thoughts on it, but I wanted to set it up by playing a guy, you know, I'm a Celtics guy, but I really do like, I like the Warriors and I like Steve Kerr. And I just wanted to play this clip. I don't know if you've seen it or heard this yet, but we're going to play this clip of him. This is Golden State Warriors coach Steve Kerr reacting to the NFL's suppression of free speech of their players. Play it. Get your reaction to it, Ben Mankiewicz, after it's over.
Reaction to the anthem.
I think it's just typical of the NFL. You know, they're just playing to their fan base, and they're just basically trying to use the anthem as fake patriotism, nationalism, scaring people. It's idiotic, but that's how the NFL has handled their business. And I'm proud to be in a league that understands patriotism in America is about free speech, about peacefully protesting. And I think our leadership in the NBA understands that when the NFL players were kneeling, they were kneeling to protest police brutality, to protest racial inequality. They weren't disrespecting the flag or the military, but our president decided to make it about that. The NFL followed suit, pandered to their fan base, that created this hysteria. And it's kind of what's wrong with our country right now. Is, you know, people in high places are trying to divide us, divide loyalties, make this about the flag, as if the flag is something other than what it really is. It's a representation of what we're about, which is diversity, peaceful protests, abilities, right to free speech. So it's really ironic, actually, what the NFL is.
Ben.
Yes.
What do you think? Perfect, right?
Well, I mean, you know, Steve Kerr, Greg Popovich, who would have said
right.
essentially the same thing, that
right.
coach of the Spurs. Yeah, I mean, they're setting the standard for how coaches should behave. And then, you know, and they're both brilliant coaches. And then you look at this brilliant NFL coach, Bill Belichick, who decides on whatever, November 2nd, I'm going to write Donald Trump a letter and tell him how great he is.
Yep.
And the letter that Belichick wrote sounded like it had been written by Trump's doctor. I mean, it literally was so, you're like, I thought it wasn't true because I thought Bill Belichick's not that dumb.
Right.
So he's, of course, completely right. There is irony that it's coming from a head coach in the NBA, a league that requires the players to stand for the anthem. It
right.
just sort of shows, but that was, you know, significantly, it's unquestionably worth mentioning, and every conversation should include this, that was collectively bargained. So the union and the players, I mean, the players and the players union and the owners came to that decision about standing together, but the NBA allows every other kind of expression. And not only allows it, but as we heard from their commissioner, who's also a really decent guy, Adam Silver today, I mean, he was trolling the NFL too. They encourage it. You know, you want to wear a Black Lives Matter t-shirt during warmups, have at it. You want it. I mean, the NBA encourages its players to be socially active and to be social justice warriors. I know it's a terrible phrase, to be a warrior for social justice.
Yeah, who would want to do that?
Hang their heads in shame, yeah.
Yeah,
so God bless Steve Kerr, and for you know, and there's another thing here that I love is that obviously that was before Game 5, and we'll leave out for a moment that they lost. But the arguments will be, and are frequently in the NFL, for why Colin Kaepernick's not signed, and even more outrageous, why his teammate Eric Reid, his teammate from San Francisco, Eric Reid, who's like somewhere between the 6th and 13th best safety in the league and is 26 years old and can't get a contract,
right,
isn't signed, is that the play, they say it's a distraction. And here's Steve Kerr, there's a time growing up, like in the 80s, where every coach would have said, yeah, I'm not going to talk about this stuff. We got a game to play. We're playing Houston tonight. They're a good ball club. We got to give 110% or we're going to be down 3-2.
Right,
and like,
right.
Hey, man, it's fine. You can answer a question and still practice and focus at the time.
Doesn't it create more distraction to ignore what's happening in the country and have a bizarre, suppressed conversation when, like, adults who are influential in American life are getting asked questions about American life? Isn't that less distracting?
Life is complicated and distracting. Professional people focus on the job at hand at the time when the job needs to be done. It's insane, but we've sort of bought into it when I was interviewing baseball players when I worked in local news in Washington, D.C., and we'd go, it'd be 5:08 and a game starts back then at 7:30. So there'd be 2 hours and 27 minutes before game, and they're taking – and I'd be like, hey, Randy, can I ask you a couple of questions? The Queen's going to visit today. I'm exciting to, play a baseball game in front of the Queen of England. No, I mean, it's the most innocuous thing in the world. Right. Hey, man, I got to focus. I got to focus on the game. Game's at 150 minutes, dude. You're batting sixth. You're not going to be up until the third inning. Calm down.
When the doorman at the building, when I walk in, he's like, hey, man, good morning. I'm like, look, it's game time. I'm hosting today. Ever speak to me?
I know. It's I can't take this call, Michael. I got scripts I got to do later today. I got to be in. Right. I'm laser focused on these. So I'm going to screw them up.
Right. I mean, I just also want to add to the mix. I mean, I think Trump, not only yesterday in that clip with Brian Kilmeade, obviously feeding the frenzy of what happened with the NFL and endorsing the policy, which obviously is disgusting but not surprising, but actually saying, like, they shouldn't even be in the locker room, maybe they should leave the country. My mind kind of immediately goes to, first of all, the dog whistle of, like, literally go back to Africa. And also, I can't help but see it as potentially a little bit of a precursor of them. In 2020, I wouldn't be surprised if they start putting stripping birthright citizenship back on the table. I know, Ted Cruz, I think, alluded to that. And I don't know. I just think, like, this deep.
Yeah, sure. I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more than about kneeling, because, again, the NBA, they have to stand.
Right. So, but that's the key distinction. They all agreed to it as a collective bargaining process.
The NFL could agree to it, but then they got to let them protest in a different way. I mean, and sort of turning your players into robots when they are public figures that you profit off the fact that they're public figures. There's nothing to be afraid of. So the problem here is that you gave Trump a win, is that these powerful NFL owners sort of, and these, Dan Snyder's the worst person in the history of sports, second worst, I guess, not as bad as Donald Sterling. I don't really have anything to say about Dan Snyder, just any conversation about the NFL. I like to mention how horrible a person Dan Snyder is and how no one should root for his team,
yes,
the team I grew up rooting for. So giving these guys a win and giving Trump this political victory is horrible, and it's a terrible solution because it puts pressure on the teams to come out. What does it mean if they don't come out? You're going to divide a team because there'll be 31 players who want to come out and stand for the flag, and they obviously should be allowed to come out and stand for the flag if they want to do it. Ultimately, and it's now greeted with cynicism, but we don't need to play the anthem at all.
right.
before a sporting event. We don't do it before a rock concert when you see U2 or you go see whoever it is you see. They don't play a concert. They don't play a concert.
I'm going to take you to a Buju Banten show. You'll take me to...
That's not a real person. Right. We don't play...
Wow. Wait a second. Wrong. I got to give you another Law and Order. That is, you're going to look up Buju after the show, Ben.
Research. I get it's a real person.
Do your research. How dare you?
There are moments when I am particularly white and particularly 51 years old, and this is one of them.
It's like, I don't know who that is.
But we used to play the anthem. I think started before during World War I, and then they played it during the 1918 World Series. Which was before the end of November of World War I, or maybe it was 1917, and it was sort of moving. But it was just the World Series. And I would say, let's opening day, all-star game, playoffs. Enough, you know?
Right.
And the NFL can do that, some variation of that as well. Game one, you want to play it again in game 17, week 17, and then the playoffs? Fine. Super Bowl? Great. But we don't need to do this every time, and we don't sort of need to force patriotism. Forced patriotism, that's what... That's what Kim Jong-un does, and it does, I got news for you. It doesn't work. These are silly, silly, stupid conversations that we end up having in this country. And then I'm also seeing lovely things like, okay, great. Well, throughout that, during the seventh inning stretch when they play God Bless America on Sundays, which I would also not do. It's a terrible song, or I'd play a different song.
Word.
We don't stop selling stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I agree completely. What is your movie recommendation? What should we watch? Ben Mankiewicz, you are literally a pro at this. A pro in telling people what to watch.
Well, I'm going to give you one old recommendation of a movie I sort of just saw again. I'm going to give you a 1952 movie, Deadline USA, about the power of the press. It's
cool.
Humphrey Bogart film, Richard Brooks directed, and it's phenomenal. And it is just a great movie that sort of ends with this really uplifting, when the press does its job, the democracy works. So go see Deadline USA. Find Deadline USA. It's phenomenal.
How can people find it? Out of curiosity, is it on Netflix?
I'm sure it's streamable.
Streamable?
Yeah, I mean,
okay.
They might have to pay for it. I don't know if it's you got to get it. I mean, you can rent it for $1.99.
Got it.
It's unquestionably worth seeing. Look, I hate superhero movies. I mean, I don't hate them. I'm just not interested in them, right?
Neither am I. I'm with you so far.
I mean, punching people in the face and having them fly into buildings and the building falls all around them and everybody's fine. Immortals fighting each other is not interesting, and somehow people were really into this. That said, Deadpool 2 is hilarious and unquestionably worth seeing.
Deadpool 1 was actually pretty funny, I have to admit. So.
Yeah, I think Deadpool 2 is funnier, and I thought Deadpool 1 was funny.
Okay.
And so I think it's worth seeing. Then there's a documentary available certainly in New York and L.A. Out this week called Film Worker, about a guy named Leon Vitelli, who was Stanley Kubrick's... He's described as his personal assistant, but that... diminishes everything, and I feel bad about saying that because that diminishes personal assistance, but he did everything, right. Everything for Kubrick. Like, Kubrick could not have made the movies he made, and Vitelli tells these stories. He really gave his life. He was going to be a successful actor. He was in Barry Lyndon, Kubrick's 75 film, and a big role, and then Kubrick sort of asked him for help, and then for the next 25 years, he just... he did casting and oversaw the restorations and coached actors like Arlie Ermey who desperately needed assistance. And found the kid in The Shining and found the twins in The Shining. And it's amazing. If you care about how movies are made and you want Kubrick stories, some of which you sort of know how much specificity he required in every task and how demanding he was. But Leon's story about how movies are made is just thrilling, and he is an incredibly appealing figure. His relationships with his kids suffered because he gave his life to Stanley Kubrick. But the stuff from Full Metal Jacket and The Shining and Eyes Wide Shut, just all by itself, it makes it worth it.
Wow. Wow. I watched a movie, a documentary that was sort of similar. I mean, not, it's a more, this sounds like a more interesting story, but this, I forget what it was called, but it was on Brian De Palma and just his work, him sort of reviewing.
I believe it was called De Palma.
De Palma, right. I watched that because you recommended that on your show, I think, and that was fascinating.
Yeah, De Palma's, I really liked De Palma. And again, you don't have to like love Brian De Palma to be into that movie, but check out Filmworker. It's really, really good, man. If you, it's just a fun, it's short, you know, it's like less than 90 minutes, so it's unquestionably worth it. And obviously, the Uptown, I'm assuming everybody's seen, you know, RBG, but obviously people should see that too.
All right.
The Ruth Bader Ginsburg doc.
Ben Mankiewicz, Turner Classic Movies, The Young Turks. I will talk with you soon, my friend.
Fantastic. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much. All right, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half.
Got a Jimmy Reefer Cake song.
Jimmy Reefer Cake song in a second. Check out The Antifada. Antifada. Patreon.com/the Is it Antifada or The Antifada?
The Antifada.
The Antifada, also available on iTunes. Patreon.com/TMBS for The Michael Brooks Show. This Sunday, we're unlocking an illicit history with Bill Fletcher Jr. on global Marxism. And illicit histories and countercurrents. Become a member of this show today, majority.fm/become a member, justcoffee.coop. On Monday, we have a pre-record for you, so there'll be new content, but we're not here. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I'm about to turn the IMs on. Jimmy Reefer Cake song now.
It's called Set the Middle East on Fire.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, by popular demand, it's Trumpy Morrison and the Whores.
Again.
Yes. All right, here I am. I'm Trumpy. You're going to ride the snake. Your fake news is so untrue. You all say I am a liar. But what if I said to you, I want to set the Middle East on fire.
Oh, yeah.
Set the Middle East on fire. Set the Middle East on fire. And get the oil to the buyer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Trumpy Morrison is back. Yeah, I'm like Trump on drugs. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Hey, I'll tell you a little more. The time to hesitate is through. To the victor goes the spoils. How the USA will never lose. We're great again, I'm taking all that oil. Yeah, all right. Set the Middle East on fire. Set the Middle East on fire. I'm gonna get the oil to the buyer. Yeah, all right, I'm a liar.
That's it?
Yeah, that's how it ends.
All right.
That was good.
Yeah, fair enough. I actually think that was the strongest of the Trump Doors series.
I agree.
I think it's a pretty accurate summary of Trump's intentions towards the Middle East.
It's one of the Doors' better melodies.
One of the Doors' better melodies for all Doors lovers. I'm not. That's actually one fight that I'm not interested in getting involved in. I'm willing to take on the, like, you know, it's like if you need to deal with like the hordes of like the Musk lunatics or the dark web twerps, but I don't.
Yeah.
If you love the Doors, then, you know, God bless you.
I mean,
I got no problem with that.
My negative feelings toward the Doors are mainly because of the kids who watched the Val Kilmer movie, and it like bleached their personality out. So like the early college, like that's really what I'm reacting to.
I missed that movie. Was that an Oliver Stone movie?
I think it was. Yes.
Yeah, oh, that was probably really bad. I see what you mean, but that would be like,
that's a lot of this.
Judging like Biggie by like the Notorious B.I.G. movie that came out, right?
Well, I think like people wouldn't really care about Nickelback except that they have a lot of fans, right? Like if they were just some,
do they have
like
a lot of fans?
Oh, Nickelback. I mean, yeah, they sell a lot of albums. I mean, they're like the sort of Clear Channel, like Nirvana.
But that would be like, I'll say something for Doors fans. If somebody says they love the Doors, I don't think to myself, what's the matter with
true,
you?
True, yeah, that's true.
But like, really, like if you like Nickelback, that what does require like a psychographic like study. Like you why just know would you
don't
like that?
Music?
Right.
Right.
Like you, I like music that is antithetical to the experience of music. For some, I don't know.
It's like going to McDonald's every day and saying you're a foodie. I just love nuggets.
I just love it. Just really into the experience. Leon Giddens. Hi, Michael. Great show. As always, fascinating listening to Ben Dixon talk about the NFL hypocrisy.
Oh, we should go to the fun half probably, right?
Oh, sorry. I thought we actually were in the fun half.
The reefer Jimmy doesn't quite take us.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right, guys. Well, you almost caught us. We're going to go to the fun half now. See you on the flip side.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. 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 And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back.